Cheerscast is a proud resident of Hanover, Indiana, and the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
What, she likes to do her cushion pushing on four wheels.
Miss Howe? Really? You know, back where I come from, we used to say something about girls like that.
What?
Let's date them.
You want to go where everybody knows your name.
Hello and welcome back to Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. I'm your host, Ryan Daly, and joining me once again is a good friend of the show, possibly the best friend, half of Jeff and Rick Presents Unpacking the Power of the Power Pack. Welcome back, Rick Heineken. What's up, man?
Not much. Just cracking a good old beer, ready to talk about some cheers, because like usual, I have brought another beer to the show.
Well,
thematically appropriate, Jolly Woodsman.
Jolly Woodsman, and there is a picture of an axe and a tree stump with it. Oh, that tree might have been named Elmer. It might have been an elm tree named Elmer.
I was really going and hoping that I'd find a chainsaw, something with a chainsaw in it. I saw the Jolly Woodsman. I thought it was still good. It's still appropriate. We have a tree stump here, which is going to feature quite prominently in there, and I might be tipping my hand a little bit about one of my favorite moments in here, but Jolly Woodsman still felt appropriate.
All right, that's good. That's good. Folks, we are talking about Season 6, Episode 7, The Last Angry Mailman. So you can probably guess who this episode is about. Don't let it dissuade you.
It's about Woody, right? It's about Woody, because, you know, Jolly Woodsman.
There you go. Yeah. There's an episode later on this season, I think, that refers to him as the Woodman. Yeah, yeah. This one is written by Ken Levine and David Isaacs, directed by James Burrows, and the original air date was Thursday, November 12th, 1987. One of Cliff's neighbors tries to get him to sign a petition blocking a development company from buying all the houses in the area and converting it for retail. Cliff would rather sell the house for a profit until Ma Clavin drags him down memory lane, reminding him of all of the cherished and not-so-cherished memories they have of a life spent in that house. When the company offers to buy them out for $250,000 in 1987 money, Esther is quick to throw their memories away, but now Cliff refuses. He handcuffs himself to a post inside the house and refuses to leave, even as the bulldozers raise everything else around the house. Touched by his attachment to the place, Esther agrees to help him fight to save their home. Norm gets a chainsaw to cut through the post, freeing Cliff. But it turns out to have been a load-bearing beam, and the house collapses on its own in front of them. Finally, Cliff's sentimental attachment to what used to be the house is broken, and he can focus on the money again. Meanwhile, Frasier discovers that when Rebecca was in college, she had quite a reputation and was known in circles as Backseat Becky. Sam and the others tease Rebecca about it mercilessly, but Sam wants to know where the name came from and why she's so cold and frosty now. Rebecca pulls Sam aside and tells him the deeply erotic story in confidence, but her sordid tale turns out to be a fiction provided and sold by Carla for $10. The real truth behind Backseat Becky remains Rebecca's secret. Big picture, overall thoughts on this episode.
First thought, you brought me back in for another Cliff episode, and I'm not sure exactly what I did to upset you, but I'm sorry. Now, that said, this is a pretty good Cliff episode. It's a little bit of character building. It's playing a lot with the mythos of who Cliff Clavin is. And we actually learn out some real fun, interesting little facts about Mr. Clavin that kind of flesh him out a bit more. And it also breaks him away from what we know about him into a little bit of a better, different character, kind of like what's been happening with Sam and the rest of the bar. Mm-hmm. So this is a changing episode for Cliff.
It is. It actually, going forward, we will see the ramifications of Cliff no longer living in this house with his mother. Speaking of which, hey, this episode, we get the return of Ma Clavin. Cliff's Ma, played by the wonderful Frances Sternhagen. The last time she was on the show, the previous season, she came in like gangbusters, was a total standout, and owned that episode, even to John Ratzenberger's detriment, because he looked horrible. Not John Ratzenberger, the actor, but Cliff looked terrible in that episode. but she is back in full force this episode. She has some great moments. One of my runners, one of my runners up for favorite moment in the episode belongs to her. It is a different kind of Cliff episode that his I don't want to say his obnoxiousness is nowhere to be found, but like it's definitely a growth kind of episode for him.
Well, his obnoxiousness actually is front and center, really, in this. The things that make Cliff what he is and make him annoying are the things that really drive the A plot of this episode. He is obstinate about one thing, and then when he goes the other way, he's not middle of the ground at all. He is always going to be one side or the other. And that's how he always portrays himself. And that's what he gets picked on at the bar for. So it's, we aren't seeing the small Cliff Clavins. We are seeing all of him.
And on the other side of the episode, we have this Rebecca subplot, which we'll get into after we talk about the teaser. But that, I think we see this new side of Rebecca as they're kind of fleshing her out. And the previous episode, the one right before this, with when Norm was painting her office, and Norm and Rebecca had this very personal moment, kind of opened her up, and we see this new side. So now I think they're really starting to have fun with the character of Rebecca and show these different shades of her, including moments of vulnerability that kind of catch you off guard that are kind of funny.
And again, I kind of want to toss this – and when you introduced this episode to me, when you said, you know, I want you to do this one, I really tossed it off. I watched it once, but the second time through watching it, I actually came around on this episode even more with that B plot and where she ends up going. There's a couple of other moments with her that really start to define who her character is going to be and how she is going to fit into this cast, which is absolutely different from Shelley Long.
Right.
Which is something you've been talking about on your show till now, is how does this change? What is the big change between where we're at now with Rebecca and how much it's changed?
Right.
Rebecca would never, or Diane would never have this kind of relationship. And we'll get into talking about that too, but
right.
This
right.
shows that how different she is yeah. from Diane.
Yeah, yeah. Getting into the teaser of the episode, we start off with a still very pregnant Carla is lying down on a couple of the bar stools. Norm is dangling a ring on a string over her very large baby bump, and it's like kind of dangling, it's swinging, it's rotating a little bit, and he's thinking, okay, maybe it's a girl, maybe it's a boy, now I can't tell. And Cliff comes in and makes a joke that you're trying to figure out what Carla is, and Carla has to kind of explain this superstition. How does she phrase it? Like, if it spins around, then it's a boy, or if it goes right to left to side to side or something, it's a girl. And if it just dangles there doing nothing, it's a Clavin.
I forgot to look this up. It was one thing I was going to told myself to look up, and I forgot until now. Just putting that in on the good old internets. Yeah, apparently that's a thing.
Yes, there's some. I don't know the full details, but I know there is some way of like divining the sex of a baby based on, I don't know, magnetic forces or something to do with how a ring spins or something. Yeah, no, this was not invented purely for the show.
No.
And then Woody comes in. He's like, you know, something that we used to do back in Hanover. He's like, you would take a fresh laid chicken egg and put it on a spoon and hold it over the woman's stomach. And if the spoon dipped, it was a boy. And if it didn't dip, or if the spoon dipped, it was a girl. If it didn't, it was a boy. And Norm was like, okay, how often did you predict the sex of the girl, of the baby? He's like, nothing. This was to predict the sex of the chicken.
Woody is becoming just the master of this. Those openings. He's got the just perfect punchline. He's got the perfect entrance and exit. He is the naivety of the farm boy. It's perfect for him.
It is. And those types of like little punches, like those are like what make so many of these classic intros, and especially when they're not tethered to the episode as a whole. That's why like just a 60-second conversation between Woody and Frasier can be worth the price of admission for an entire episode just between them. And all right, so getting into the episode, I think we kind of agreed, instead of taking this purely chronologically, we're going to divide this because there are two different plots. There's the A plot with Cliff and his house, and then there's the B plot with Rebecca and her nickname, and they don't really overlap in any substantive way. So it's just, and there's a lot of jumping back and forth because of the passage of time. So let's just take one at a time, flip a coin, we'll start with Backseat Becky.
Woohoo!
Yeah. Frasier comes in talking, saying, you know, it's a great time of year for psychiatrists because everybody is miserable. And they talk about, you know, paranoia and rampant, like, fear and, like, economic, like, all of these, like, every reason to be depressed or upset going on in society's ills. He's like, yeah, it's a boon time for psychiatrists.
It's thriving. It's never been better for me. And this is after he comes in very jolly for Frasier, too, and saying, hey, do you have one more – do you have room for one more toss pot? Which, you know, once again, throwing out the archaic language. Fantastic.
And he's very happy with himself for coming up with that one. Like, he laughs a little bit at that joke, and they're like, sure.
He laughs more than the audience does.
Yes.
Because the audience is like, what did he say? And he's just chuckling up a storm on that one. Yeah.
So he comes in, and he and Carla have this wonderful little banter because he's like – he says that he has some information that brought up with that he was having lunch with a colleague, and he learned some information about somebody that they're all acquainted with. And everybody kind of leans in, you know, Sam, Carla, Norm, and the tertiary barflies are all like, all right, who is it? And Carla's like, is it juicy? Like, in the gossip? He's like, yes. He's like, it could embarrass somebody, most definitely. And Carla's like, is it me? He's like, no. She's like, then spill it. She has to check herself first. Yeah. So,
and so much fun. This is the interaction right here of, you know, guy coming with juicy story, everybody getting in, the whole fun banter back and forth. This is what makes it the bar where you want to go to.
Of course, the fact, yeah, as characters as disparate as Carla and Frasier, that they can have this kind of just the flow of the dialogue just between this, yeah. So Frasier mentions that his colleague went to the University of Connecticut with a Rebecca Howe and said that she was quite the party girl in college. The gang is interested, they're intrigued, but also a little bit skeptical. They're like, are you sure it's our Rebecca?
Yeah, the one whose knees were bolted together.
Yes,
which, wow.
Or how does Carla say, Miss Granite panties or something like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, I don't know if
they
it's the same.
They paint some fantastic word pictures here.
And Cliff says, you know, he's like, yeah, I can see that being the truth. He's like, it's always us quiet, reserved types that, when properly stimulated, he says, turn into an average churning hunk of burning funk.
It took me like 3 times rewinding it to figure out how to write that down.
Churning hunk of burning funk. And that's, of course, one of the many times when they question Cliff's grip on reality. Like, Norm is like, at what point were you just riding along and reality turned left and you just went way to the right?
You took a sharp right.
Yeah. So then Rebecca comes in, and, you know, the guys are all like, yeah, we know something, and they're just like, and they're like, Sam, you gotta find out if this is her, how you can do it. So, of course, he's just like, we were just talking about college, because that's...
No. He says, we were just talking about college. He just sells, every time he says college, he is selling that one word. We're talking about college. He's trying to just... Prepper, you know, we want to find out some things.
Yeah, but prime the audience and prime, like, his friends too, this is what we're biting on. And she's like, you were talking about college? And again, going back to it, he's like, yeah, well, you know, if I ever wanted to go, you know, what could I expect? And she's like, 2,000 people like you. So he kind of asks, he's like, you know, where did you go to college? Where did you go to college? And she throws it back. She's like, University of Connecticut. And of course, everybody, and like before, like Sam doesn't even like forgets about her because he's just got to run back to the guys. Like, yeah, it's like it's the same one there.
And of course, they react.
Yeah.
And she wants to know what's so interesting. And so they're like, oh, well, we love. And Norm's like, we love Connecticut and their mascot, the fighting salesman,
the fighting insurance salesman. Yeah, which I think says more about the time of this episode that like. Like, nobody thought anything of the UConn sports team and everything like that, but they didn't even know their mascot. For the record, it's the University of Connecticut Huskies. Their football team has improved, but I think, like, for the last 20 years, their basketball program, the boys' basketball, but especially the women's basketball team, has been, like, the dominant dynasty in NCAA. Is the UConn women's basketball team, like, the most blockbuster program of, like, the last... 10-15 years. But yeah, no, I think that just has more to do with the time, because if this was written today, I think they, like, yeah, UConn's sports program is much better known. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, we're talking Final Four. Yeah.
A day passes with some other stuff we'll come back to. The next day, Frazier comes in, tells the others that in college, Rebecca was known as Backseat Becky. He doesn't know the reason for that, but of course everybody can speculate, except for Woody, who's like, what might that, what could that possibly mean?
And of course, once again, you and I, and our favorite thing ever is to point out those lovely scenes that are from the Cheers 200th episode. And here's one of them with Woody saying,
such a
good
one. It's such a good one.
It's such a great one.
Because Cliff is going to explain it, and Carla's like, no, why don't you let somebody who has actually been there explain it? And she discusses, she likes to do her cushion pushing on four wheels, the cushion pushing. And amazingly, Woody knows exactly what she's talking about. He's like, wow, Miss Howe, really? Yeah. He's like, you know, back in Indiana, we used to have a saying about girls like that. Let's date them.
What is it?
Let's date them.
And once again, it's him coming back to the back home in Indiana. Because like Cliff, it's a little known fact. Back home in Indiana, it's the beginning of something. We don't know what it is. And usually it's his oblivious. But then him coming back saying, ah, nah. No, she's one of those girls. We know those girls. That's universal right here.
Yeah, anytime he says, like, back home or home on the farm or back in Indiana, that is a signpost for some kind of folksy thing that is just going to be like, what the hell? I love it. By the end of the series, a couple seasons from now, like, they treat Hanover as this mythical place. Just like, they're really, these, like, magic people live. Like, Norm actually says it. Somebody's like, before I die, I have to visit that place.
A town full of Woodies. Oh, we could only imagine.
So when Rebecca comes in, they're like saying, like, hey, we were just talking about how everybody has a nickname, and did you ever have one? And she says, no. And they're like, no, really? No, we need to come up with one for you. And they're throwing out, okay, well,
something,
it's got to be something
dignified.
Yeah, something dignified, right.
Dignified.
Right.
Something reserved.
Yeah, professional. You know, all these things that really describe her. And Sam, just on cue, he's like, what do you say, guys? What could it be? And as one, the bar goes, Backseat Becky. And the look on Kirstie Alley's face is just like the color just drops. Like, you see the color down out of her face, like from the forehead down through her chin to like her clothes and everything. And then her whole body just follows suit as she tries to hide behind the bar.
Just straight down in the bar. It's the comic beat is perfect. Absolute. Because you think, how would Diane react to something like that? She would get flustered, she would get angry, she would do whatever. Rebecca just disappear. Oh my God, this is my worst fear realized.
Right, and totally blindsided, like has no idea. But like, and like this facade of like all business, whatever the story behind this, that could just unravel everything that they know and any sense of authority and integrity that she might have, that she's clinging to, could all be washed away. Because she comes up like holding her face, like, oh gosh, now you guys know the whole sordid story. And perhaps as a mistake, Fraser's like, well, no, we don't. And she's like, oh, there isn't one. She's like, yeah. And then, well, what are some of the lies that she comes up with? She says she was a real go-getter. That was the second one. Like, what's the...
Yeah. No, the second one was that she was a real go-getter.
She never took a backseat to anybody.
To everybody.
And they just kind of look around like, no, that's not the story.
Oh, I can't. I didn't have the first one written down there because they went by really quick on there. Yeah. But as she's talking about, they're just,
it was like, you know,
making the comments of
how,
like,
people come up with nicknames ironically, like how you call somebody the opposite of what they are. You know, that's why they call her Backseat Becky. You know,
that's right.
And they're like, oh, that's kind of logical, but we don't believe it.
And then they start, you know, hey, what model has the best rear shocks? Have you driven a Ford lately? Oh, now we know what it means by four on the floor. And everybody's just picking, just hitting. And because she won't tell them the truth, they won't stop.
Right, yeah. And it comes back to later on, like the kind of final scene in the subplot when Rebecca walks out and Sam says, he refers to her as the ultimate driving machine. Is like the last one, and then she says she will tell him the truth, but she has to do it somewhere private. So she pulls him into the hallway, and at this point, She launches into the story from straight from the back of one of those magazines. You know what I'm talking about.
You know the ones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you don't know the ones, ask Irving Mulshag. He's got a lot of them.
I swear to God this happened, and you'll never believe it.
By the way, Shag might have actually written a few of those. I'm not sure. I'm not going to call people out of class, but, you know, it's what I saw in the bathroom wall. Yeah.
So she starts telling him in a very kind of whispery, sultry voice the story of her in college. The fire alarm goes off at her all-girls dorm.
But it starts off normal.
Yeah.
And the further on she gets, then we start getting more of the sultry in.
Right, right, right. But like she does, like the detail of her having to rush out of the, you know, burning dorm in just a black teddy, like see through kind of. So
see through.
Yeah,
see through.
And then the fire truck comes in, and she has to like hide from the headlights. So she jumps in the back of this open convertible. And the firefighter sees her, and she's like, "I knew what he wanted, and I wanted it too." And they get into, and then
I looked in his eyes.
Yeah, and of course, this whole time as she's traveling, you just see Sam like holding the towel that he was washing the bar with, just kind of closer and closer and tighter. And she's telling the story of her having this affair with a firefighter, and then them looking around, and they weren't alone. The entire dorm and all the firefighters had been watching them, and nobody said a word. And that's how they got the nickname and everything. And she's like, "That's how I got the nickname." And Sam just starts dabbing the bead of sweat on his forehead. And just, I don't think he even says a word. He just has to walk past her and go into the bathroom down the hall.
No, he's in the pool room. And he's just straight into the pool room.
Oh, yeah,
gone,
yeah.
Just out of sight. Yeah.
Yeah. And she kind of walks away. And then she takes out a $10 bill and she goes, "Thanks for the story, Carla."
And Carla responds back, "Well, the $20 story would have killed him." Hey, why? And then Carla follows it up with, "Why? What really happened?" And she goes, "Oh, that'll cost you $100."
That'll cost you $100.
But this is where I was talking about that the relationship that develops now between Carla and Rebecca. You see it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a close of a female friend as she's got. Never would have had something like this with Diane. And it's something you see exists throughout the show. They're kind of talking on the same level now, and you don't have that animosity of like, oh, she's just a mean boss. That lets Rebecca's hair down just a little bit, and Carla can kind of see, okay, she's one of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, she's got their levels, and I think by Carla's thinking, levels of depravity to this woman that, yes, I didn't expect, and that makes her one of Cheers. Like,
yeah,
like she didn't fit, she was above Cheers, and now Carla recognizes, yeah, like, no, this woman, she's not above us. Yeah.
Yeah, and what didn't exist between her and Diane, they weren't one of the girls that could just hang out together.
Mm-hmm.
Carla could see that, you know, yeah, she could hang out. I mean, they're not going to hang out, but I mean, they can get together on do things now. She can be part of the schemes, mm-hmm, and there's not just the animosity that exists.
Right. I mean, any more than there's animosity between Carla and anybody.
Well, I mean, she's above yeah, Cliff now. So, I mean, really at that point in time.
So now the question, is this story autobiographical for Carla, or is this just something that she made up or that she'd heard secondhand and gave the details to Rebecca?
Well, one, she's never been to college.
So
window. More or less probably that she got interrupted from being with one other boy and like something happened and she had to dive into a car and then got seen by another. It could possibly be with a couple of things switched around. I mean, it's Carla.
I can see her trying to jump a firefighter who's showing up to a burning building or something like that, or to check something like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. And given like, yeah, I can even see, like, yeah, the voyeuristic part of it being a turn on for her. But anyway,
Or the other side, too. I think we might have called it early on. Carla reads those magazines. You know Carla reads those magazines. You know Carla reads. It's trashy romance. She's not a voracious reader, but you know, if she's going to read anything, it's going to be a trashy romance novel.
There
so,
you go.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. All right. So we leave with this new relationship between Carla and Rebecca, at least teased, a new standing, and Sam completely undone. You know, he we know that he has the hots for Rebecca and he wants to sleep with her, but now when actually confronted by like what she's capable of, like it might even be more than he can handle, at least in this context, like that he had to be chased off by her. So we have that now for the other plot, the what is ostensibly the main plot of this episode, Cliff's house. So Cliff's neighbor, Jim McNulty, played by Kevin Dunn, who just one of those actors that you've seen in everything. And I actually forgot to look up. Does he show up more as more than one character in Cheers?
I don't know. I need to look that up myself.
Let me look that up really quickly, because he's in so many movies and so many TV shows playing these types of characters that I'm always like, for all I know, he's in Cheers like five different times playing different characters.
Nope, just one episode of Cheers.
Okay, just this one.
But this is early in his career. This is one of the things that kind of got him out there. He about second year of doing some stuff. So yeah, this is early in his career, but there we go.
Yep. So yeah, Kevin Dunn, you've seen him before, but he comes in looking for Cliff, and Woody kind of screens for him. He's like, does Mr. Clavin know you're looking for him? And
it was a little odd, but it does come back later on for a second hit. It's actually one of those little jokes.
Yeah, he's like screening.
It kind of works, and I see the setup for before. It's probably one of those like swings and misses, but that's okay. Yeah. It's the high joke content, and it's all good. So. Right.
So further establishing that Cliff doesn't get along well with anybody, like he and his neighbor start ridiculing each other in their homes, like right away. Cause the guy's like, or Cliff says, are you ever going to take your Christmas lights down? And he's like, yeah, maybe some weekend when you're not having a garage sale or a yard sale or something like that. That joke probably worked when they were writing it, but considering this episode aired in mid-November, I don't think that would be the perfect time to take the Christmas lights down.
Actually, or it's perfect. Are you ever going to take down your Christmas lights from last year?
Yeah, but at this point,
maybe.
Yeah,
it's still it's how neighbors talk to each other.
Exactly.
It's like, wow, you still got the lights up,
Yeah.
Or it's like me talking to Jeff. You know, Jeff, I see we're recording. I still see your Christmas lights outside, dude. It's February, man.
So, the neighbor wants Cliff to sign this petition to keep this new development firm from buying out their houses, and Cliff welcomes the development because it'll raise the property value. They get into a fight because the guy's like, you know, you people don't care about the sense of community and the camaraderie and what good neighbors all bring to each other, and beautifying the neighborhood. And Cliff's like, if you really want to make it look better, you'll stay inside. And the guy comes back, he's like, at least I don't live with my mother. And Cliff's like, I've seen your mother. And he's like, my mother's a saint.
Yeah.
And Cliff comes back pretty funny. He's like, yeah, Saint Bernard. And the guy makes a run for him, like comes out, and Cliff just up and bolts all the way down the hallway to the thing, just like scooting, just like past people. And the guy's like, all right, forget it. And then the best part is Cliff comes back like nothing. He's like, ah, damn it, Norm, somebody already reserved the pool table. Just passing it off like that.
I mean, we have seen this time and time again. Cliff Clavin is the world's biggest coward unless he has got his friends there. And he's, you know, mouthing off to this guy and all of a sudden realizes, oh, wait, I'm not behind my friends.
Yeah. Because this time he didn't have a large black postal carrier who may have had a former career in boxing, you know, to have his back. So this time when he actually was threatened, he had to run. So then we get a new setting, a new location in the season. The Clavin household, or an inside look at the set, which considering how much they will have to dress the set and how lived in and like real it looks for just this one scene, and the next time we see it, it's completely barren and empty. But for the moment,
almost completely barren and empty. One thing left in that house.
But the first time we see it, we see their kitchen, or the door to their kitchen, but also like their dining table where they're eating, and then we get into the living room. There's a nice portrait of Ronald Reagan, which I thought was just kind of like a funny little touch until they actually show the close-up at the very end. But anyway, at first, when it was just kind of there in the background, I'm like, yeah.
A giant portrait of Ronald Reagan right above an indoor mailbox.
Like an old-fashioned, but as it starts, Esther is talking about Yorkshire pudding, and she has all this trivia knowledge, and of course it's a little-known fact, and we're like, oh yeah, this is where he gets it. And Cliff, the lack of self-awareness.
Yeah, he mocked his mom.
Yeah, he's like, this is why nobody wants to hang out with us. And the lack of self-awareness, because later on, the next time we see him at the bar, he's in the middle of telling them the same stuff about Yorkshire pudding. So,
which, you know, he made some weird jump to get through. Just, and that's the moment when you realize this is just learned behavior. He picks up from his mom and brings it. Beautiful.
Cliff is clearing the table. Esther mentioned that she did sign the petition, and she sees the value in the house that Cliff, for lack of a better term, grew up in. And he's just like, you know, we could make a boatload and everything. And then she has this phone again, another one of my runners up for this episode, when she brings out the scrapbook, but she's like, sounds like somebody needs to take another look at the scrapbook. And she has
not
this
the scrapbook, sing song.
Yeah. And he's not the scrapbook, but her sing song way of delivering it. And his very like 10-year-old boy is kind of like, no, mom. And then what is she starts singing, misty watercolored memories of the way we were.
They just took like, they distilled down some of the parts of Cliff Clavin and they just gave it to this lady. And it's like, what is the woman that would bring into this world this guy?
Yeah. And well, There are two little details that they're talking about before they get into the tree, Elmer, but like two details that are like really kind of weird on their own.
Oh,
one of them
is
he used to slide down the banister and like just like almost rub himself up and down the banister. She's like, I think you did that too much.
You spent too much time sliding down that banister. It was for fun.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, what are we saying here?
Yeah,
what,
it's like there's something.
What's going on?
There was something going on there.
And then his favorite hiding place was the closet.
The closet. And she says, you used to be in there for hours. And he says, which before any...
But like, that's it. Right there. The audience laughter, and it stops. And you're like, what are we listening... What is going on here? What is this? And then they come up with this second line, which is like...
That's because you locked the door on me. her explanation is, well, it worked because look how you're such a polite young man now.
I mean, there is so many things to unpack there. It's like, are we saying that he is a closeted homosexual that she kind of was destroying, or did she purposefully make him this way, or... So the relationship has got weirder in that little bit. It was like, wow.
I think the initial idea, just like saying he was hiding in the closet, today we automatically leap to that assumption. And maybe that was the plan, like in 87, that's where we went. Mm. But I think the explanation of what ended up happening, where she took it, hints at something completely different. Like that was a form of punishment. Where like she locked him in there. And she's like, look how polite you are. You're such a polite young man. Like, he had to buy his way out of there just through, like, manners and everything like that. Like, this was some kind of conditioning. I don't think it necessarily has much to do with his sexuality, but just his relationship with her in either event. It's like, ugh, I'm getting uncomfortable now.
And the falls right on the sliding down the banister. And also, they were talking about what a handsome picture of you. And, even my ears are covered with acne. Yeah. But it's like, there's just a lot of weird stuff there.
Yeah.
But then we get to talking about something normal and adult and understandable. His best friend in the entire world. Elmer.
A tree, an elm tree that he planted himself and treated like his brother. And he was like, he's like basically in awe that something that he planted, nurtured with his hands, can grow on for future generations to play with. And she's like, well, unless the new developers cut it down to build a Jiffy Lube.
And this gets him all riled up. Now we see Cliff take the 180 degrees. He is not for progress anymore. He is for conserving those things he loves. And he's going to do something like going to sit in his tree.
So anyway, the next day, they're at the bar and Esther comes in with Mr. Cronin from the company, whatever it is, who wants to buy the house. And they're seem like they're a united front. They're like, no, we're not going to do it. He offers them $250,000. And...
Okay, I got something on this here.
All right.
I got something. I got to jump in here. $658,000 in today's money. $658,000.
All right. I'm not an expert in Boston real estate.
Medium price around that time, I looked that up too, was around $131,000 for one family house.
So almost double, like pretty much double.
Yeah.
That's I would sell.
I need to tell you, I
would sell. Yeah, actually,
sold.
Probably without inflation, but that's.
I recently sold a rental property, and we bought it at 168, and we sold it about 370. Yeah. We did great on that, but yeah, I mean that was over time. We were hitting the market. That is double the market what they're asking there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's nuts. So yeah, like she's like, oh, we're rich, and all of her sentiment just evaporates, and there's the great moment. It's like, what are we gonna like? What do we do if we don't have the house anymore? And she says, now I can go to Florida, and Cliff, like, if you don't know the history, then his next line, because he says, Florida, who would ever want to live in that stinkhole? If you don't know the history of the show, or Cliff, if you just started watching the show, then it's just a guy hating on Florida, which is low-hanging fruit, but, you know, just kind of common.
Today.
Yeah. But if you know Cliff, and like particularly like from seasons 2 and 3, and how much he talked about it, and when he actually traveled there, and how much he wanted to go back, and how obsessed he was with bringing everything back to Florida, then this line is priceless. Because she's like, I can go to Florida. Yeah. He's like, who would want to go to Florida?
We also get another line here, too, where she says, you are 39 years old. It's time to cut the cord. Now, my wife watching this with me just stopped and said, he's 39?
Yeah, like this.
I'm feeling good about my age, man. I don't know about you, man. If he's 39, me at 47, I'm feeling great about my life.
Yeah, and I think I had all of their ages when this show started. So at this point, Norm is around the same age, 40, 41, maybe, if he was like the same age as the actor. Yeah, that's nuts.
As she's leaving, he starts yelling, well, you're going to have to cook your own meals. You're going to have to do your own dishes. You're going to have to wash your own hair. You'll be back. Can we just say once again, whoa.
Yeah. Washing the hair is kind of like, all right. The next time there is later on in the bar, Esther comes in looking for Norm. Woody stops her at the door and kind of does the same screening thing. He's like, does Mr. Peterson know you're looking for? And she just brushes past him. She's like, Norman. And she's like, yeah, I can't get Cliff out of the house. He's handcuffed himself. She got it. He's like, all right, I'll go help. So he goes, and then
the last thing she wants to see is his face on the news.
And Carla's like, yeah, the whole city is right there with you. So we go back to the house, and the same set, but now stripped of everything. The whole house has been emptied and gutted except for, what is it?
The picture of Ronald Reagan.
The picture of Ronald Reagan. Still then President Reagan.
It's going to be Cliff and Ronnie going down together.
And Cliff is handcuffed to one of the beams in the center, and he's like, he mentioned that he flushed the key.
The only beam. Yeah. The only beam in this house.
Yeah, the whole house. So he's handcuffed. He can't get there. Esther sends Norm. She's like, go get some cutters. Ask for Biff. He's the one who loaned us the hard hats.
Norm's like, get some tin snips. Get some tin snips. Yeah.
Yeah. And the Norm's moment before this, actually, I think, is my home run. So we'll come back to that one, how the scene actually opens. I want to save that one. But when, you know, Esther, you know, when there, it's just her and Cliff, and she says, you know, it's too late to protest. The house is sold. It's going to be destroyed. They can't do anything. Cliff points out the remains of Elmer. He's got, like, just these branches and, like, this just little kindling in the center of the floor. It's like, that's all that's left of the tree. It's like he carried him a dead body.
He threw it in from the window. I mean, it was just...
It's like he killed my brother. Look what he did to my boy. And at this point, his mother is swayed by the sentiment. She agrees that she's like, we'll find a lawyer and we'll fight to save our home. And then Norm comes in with a chainsaw.
Come on.
Yeah,
we're going to talk about Norm with the chainsaw. Let me tell you, Norm with the chainsaw.
Because at first he's trying. At first it looks like he's going to try and cut the handcuffs, like the chain, and like Cliffy's like,
that's what he's racing. He goes,
yeah, like, like
Cliff's moving his hands up and down there. He goes, would you stop it? Hold still. I want to cut the handcuffs. He goes, no. You're going to miss. Cut the pillar.
Yeah. So he's like,
and then he says, it's just decorative. It's fine.
So he finally, Norm cuts through the post and everything, and Norm or Cliff is able to pull the bottom of the beam down so that he can get his hands free. And they're excited. They're like, "Yeah, all right, yeah, we're gonna start. We're gonna fight this thing. We're taking it to court. Screw the man." And then,
but first, I'm gonna treat you boys to a popsicle.
And then you just hear, whew, the sound effects work in this episode. But yeah, like the groans of the wood and the creaking, all the plaster and everything coming apart.
It's probably just a squirrel. It's probably just a squirrel. Yeah. It's probably just a squirrel.
And they go to the door and, then it was saying, and just boom, everything from the second floor just comes down right into the living room. Everything just starts caving in. And that post, yeah, it turns out that post was kind of necessary for the structural foundation of the house.
And it's just an amazing, thinking that they did this on a set and just having all that stuff come down, that is impressive. It works very well. It's a lot for a one-time use thing. I mean, they destroy it.
Right. Yeah, no, it's incredible and so fun. They must have, somebody missed a decimal point because they got their budget for that episode and they're like, hey now, we can do something here.
Hey now, we can do this. But yeah, they come in again for the last bit, and we got a quarter mil for this dump.
Perfect. And then he closes the door, and the picture of Ronald Reagan just drops and shatters, and the frame shatters.
Chef's kiss. There chef's kiss. I mean, is it a great episode? No. Does it have some fantastic little moments in it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Great character development, too.
Yeah.
So it's a good episode. It really is enjoyable. It's fun to watch. It's not one that tends to stand out, but like I said, it's got some good moments in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It does. Cliff comes on. Cliff's obnoxiousness is kind of driving because we see how quick he is to change his position, how he doesn't actually feel. He has this righteous devotion to whatever side he takes, but he's so willing to switch that it doesn't come across as loyalty to anything other than his own self-interest. But in this case, it doesn't make him look too bad just because it's something that we kind of understand where he's coming from in terms of his sentimentality to the house, and because his mom is right there kind of holding his hand with him, literally or figuratively.
And it's on both sides, too. I mean, when he first talks about it, he goes, yeah, you know, give things up, progress has to happen, in it for the big buck. Okay, we can get that. We were talking about that. Selling, the high point of the market. Yeah, you want to do that. But then you also get the sentimentality of the house, and we all can feel that too. That's where I grew up. This is my memories. And she brings up the scrapbook. These are the memories of the house, the memories that we have together. So both sides are legit. But yeah, he just flips on a dime.
Actually, the shocking thing is that, I'm surprised there wasn't some reveal at the end that they weren't getting the money, that they were basically just, they lost the house and they weren't going to come out, really well off on this.
Well, they were tearing down the house anyways. I mean, if anything else, the construction crew's like, you know what? Here's a little bit extra money because you saved our guys a day on the job.
Right. if Cliff wasn't so fanatical about the U.S. Post Office, you'd think we'd never see him again. He would leave Boston. He'd leave there. But anyway. Speaking of Cliffy and sort of set dressing, it's a little known fact, my trivia for this episode, the infamous painting of Geronimo that was in Nicky Calasanto's dressing room and then got, after his passing, after the death of Coach, got moved to the back of the Cheers set. It was absent for the first couple episodes of this season. Because of how Rebecca kind of changed everything when she took over the bar at the beginning of the scene. But now, starting with this episode, the picture is in that back corner back there again, and there it will remain. It sort of changes position, but it's always back there, and it will be back there for the rest of the show.
Good, because it's another one of the things that comes out of that 200th episode of Cheers where they talk about that, and it just becomes a sentimental part, and if you know, you start seeing it on the set, you know, hey, he's still in there. He's still part of the bar. When the season started, there was a bit of me like, it's not there, but you know it's going to come back one day.
Yep. For Norm's tab, because there's so much kind of jumping around in time and time passage here, he had 5 beers this episode. Remember, he was just at the perfect round number of 500 last episode, so now he is up to 505 for the series right now.
Yeah. That's my boy.
Employee of the week, who is your MVP this time around?
You know, this is a Cliff episode. He does a great job in it, but I had to give it to Rebecca. I had to give it to Rebecca, and it's just because of the two things we talked about. Her reaction at the bar when she gets that line at the backseat Becky and she drops, the color drops from her face and she drops out of frame. The timing beat is perfect. And then her sultry story to Sam and how she sells that. She has a few moments in here where she's hitting the beats and she is just perfect. I wanted to give it to Cliff, but I was so impressed with how Rebecca hit those marks, and I just found myself enjoying what she was doing in this episode. I kind of had to give it to her.
You read my notes. I had like the exact same idea. I was thinking about Cliff, and I was like, oh, it's a Mock Clavin episode. Maybe Mock Clavin will get the MVP because of how good she was in her first appearance. But no, watching this one, I was like, oh, Rebecca. She did so good, and it's because of those two standout moments, her first reaction to hearing backseat Becky and the how mortified she is and the dread and the turnaround and how she awkwardly tries to hide it. And then, yeah, the way she sells the story just like that as a monologue is just incredible. I was like, yeah, that the whole episode, like, those are almost the best moments, yeah.
I know you're going to ask us next about Home Run, and we're talking best moments. I'm going to go ahead and just jump right in, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Norm with a chainsaw. Norm with a chainsaw, enough said. There were some funny moments in here. There's some funny lines. But when Norm came in with that chainsaw and just him wielding it and Cliff just getting freaked out and going up and down, I had to. I mean, he's got a hard hat on and he's got a chainsaw and it's Norm. And yet you're sitting here like, can we buy it? It's just so ridiculous, but beautiful.
Yeah. My home run is actually just moments before. You know what? I have to amend my previous award for the employee of the week. It's not Rebecca. The standout for this episode is whoever the sound engineer is or the Foley artist. Because of, like, in the last 2 minutes of the episode, between the effects of the chainsaw, the effect of the house collapsing. But before that, how the scene begins, my home run, when Norm and Esther show up at the house and you just hear the sound of the jackhammers and the bulldozers and all of the construction outside, and Norm starts talking, and they're like, all three of them are talking in the house and you can't hear what they're saying. It's just the pantomiming of their voices moving. You don't hear any dialogue, and Norm is shouting at Cliff and getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally you hear the whistle, like it's the Flintstones, the steam whistle. It's the end of the construction shift, and all of the construction machinery shuts down, and that cacophony of noise just stops, and we get their voices again, and Norm, in mid-rant, you just hear him saying, "The world's biggest ass!" He's just shouting that. That's all we... Whatever he was talking about before that, just that's how angry he's shouting this at Cliff. And I'm like, oh my god. That moment just...
And once again, everybody is just saying, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was my favorite part. My home run was just like that whole setup with like 45 seconds of like construction machinery noise, just back noise drowning everything, and then just the end of Norm shouting this curse at Cliff. The close runner-up to behind that would be all of Rebecca's story, her whole monologue about backseat Becky, just start to finish is an amazing thing. And then somewhat distantly behind that is Mock Clavin going, "I think it's time to look at the scrapbook," and just like the way she says those lines. And Cliff's like, "No, not the scrapbook."
Yeah, that just and the bar just teasing backseat Becky and
yeah. Have you driven a Ford lately? Yeah.
The old. Well, I had another one we missed too. The ultimate driving machine.
Yeah. All right, well, Rick, thank you very much.
any episode that once again leaves us just gasping for breath and just like, ah, hey, that was a good laugh we had.
It was, and I mean, again, this is one of those things where I wanted to, because I know they're fans of the show, and I've heard from fans of the show that basically abandoned ship when Shelley Long left, or they said they did stick with it, but they never thought it was the same show, and it was never as good. And I love Diane and Sam and their relationship and their whole saga through these first 5 years. I have said that from the beginning, but I have also said the reworkings and the retoolings and what they're able to do with the character dynamics, the show, it might have lost a little bit in the dramatic and the romantic tension when Shelley left, but what it gained in humor, I just think these next couple of seasons are funnier, pound for pound, than the last couple seasons with Diane.
You have more of a chance to explore. You don't have the Sam and Diane show.
Right.
You've got the ensemble, and you've talked about it before on your podcast. They are working together. They are an ensemble of characters that they're going to get their own time. They're going to get their chance to shine. We get to see Norm as a painter. We get to see Cliff trying to save his house. We get to see Woody, you know, making friends with, you know, Evan Drake. And you get to see these characters stretching their legs a bit more, and these actors stretching their legs and doing some things that build them as characters. And we start to see them actually become fleshed out people, which for being a bunch of barflies, that's pretty impressive. And you wouldn't get that with more of the same. I love Sam and Diane too. And rewatching the show with this podcast has given me a chance to really explore those early episodes. But that story was done.
Yeah.
They needed to move on. Yep. And it is not the same show. But that doesn't mean that the show is any less for it.
Right.
It's Cheers 2.0. And that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great, I think. It's great. All right, Rick. Well, thank you very much for being on this episode. And I know I will have you back in the future. But until then, where can listeners find you if they want to hear more from you?
Me and my co-host Jeff, who does not have a chainsaw, but he does own a flamethrower. Well, we do a show called Unpacking the Power of Power Pack, where we review comics that have a member of Power Pack in them, and we talk about them. It's kind of random right now, but we are in a chronological order, which means we're in the middle of Fantastic Four. Come and listen to us. We have a good time. I also sometimes do a show called Monthly Monday Movie Muckabout on Longbox Crusade Network, your rival network. You know, I know you guys have fights and all that stuff, but let's be nice. Let's be friends. Let's have a drink at the bar. But check out my show there. Check out Unpacking the Power Pack. Come and find me. Let's talk.
Fantastic. And thanks to all of you out there who listen to Cheerscast and support the show by liking, sharing on social media, and leaving comments on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also support the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/FWPodcast to support your favorite show on the Fire and Water Network. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next time, we're closed.